Welcome to the Sunbury Press Book Show on the BookSpeak Network. Sunbury Press publishes print, electronic, and audiobooks under a variety of imprints and categories, available worldwide wherever books are sold. And now your host, the founder and CEO of Sunbury Press, Lawrence Knorr.
Hello, I'm Tori Gates, producer of the Sunbury Press Book Show. I'm also the host of the BookSpeak Network's Brown Posey Press Show. In this program, we will offer the second of two podcasts covering the annual Writers' Conference of Northern Appalachia, also known as WCONA. The conference included several workshops, discussions, and talks regarding this part of the U.S. Among those who appeared at the conference, Hillary Hawk, who hosted a session on the craft of writing, which she will discuss. She is also the author of From Ashes to Song on the Milford House imprint. Hillary spoke of her experience at WCONA.
Oh, it's been going absolutely wonderfully. Last night, the open mic, it was so much fun. It's so great to see so many talented writers in one place.
And I was talking with PJ Petrarillo, and he was very optimistic about the growth of it. And obviously, you've been to these before. What kind of growth have you seen?
Well, this is just my second one, so okay. I haven't seen the whole journey. But I don't know. Last year was really good, too. But I do feel that there are more attendees this time, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the writing, the thing that seems to be a theme is that not only are we talking about Appalachia and the history of it, but it's coming forward now. The craft is coming forward, and the different authors are stepping up. And I am gathering you're seeing some of that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. There's a celebration of the history, the industry. I personally fascinated by it. You can tell from my accent I'm not from around here, but I have lived in this area for about 20 years, and this area inspired my first ever stories. So there are a lot of stories here to be told.
And you delved into that with some of your writing. We've talked about it. How has it influenced you, maybe from the beginning of your literary career to now and as you go forward?
That's a good question. Well, I think because I've moved countries a few times, I think seeing a different culture really is something I can write about. So it really inspires me to see the difference in people, the different ways people live. And it makes it back into my stories, even when I'm writing stories about other places.
Right. And you have a worldly experience that so many of us don't have, living in different parts. And it's like those elements always come with you, don't they?
They do. They do. They always work themselves into my stories. Yes.
Yeah. And tell us about some of your writing. What are you working on now? What's coming in the future for you?
Well, I'm writing on a story about a place that doesn't actually exist, but it could exist.
Okay.
Somebody comes from out of town and disrupts the status quo, and it's really about how we treat each other.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you were hosting a talk called All Is Lost.
That's right, yes.
Tell us about this, because this is a subject that is talked about in writers' groups. It's talked about at conventions and so forth. And it's sort of like that part of the story where do you go from here, or do you? Tell us about your formatting of it and that kind of thing.
Yeah, okay. So the All Is Lost moment is actually a moment that happens in a story about three quarters of the way through, but it's somewhere that I quite like to begin the story, because we had a keynote this morning, Maxwell, he talked about the soul of the story.
Max King, yes.
Yes, yeah, and I really think that the All Is Lost moment is the soul of the story. It's when, you know, the character cannot move forward anymore. They've been trying to resolve the issue. They're deep in an abyss. They're at rock bottom, and they are forced to change. And I don't know if we always notice it as readers, even when we're watching movies, but it's always there. And it's the really epicenter of the book when everything changes.
Mm-hmm. And that's a part of the process. That's a part of our writing. And being a writer is when you have those moments and you have to have the transitions. You have to have the changes. And no book needs to be this, this, and this, but it is
right.
A part of it. Well, I guess the main thing I would like to end with is, What is, when you have an aspiring writer or somebody that doesn't know how to proceed, what is the one best piece of advice you can give?
They don't know how to proceed. Sit down and write. You don't need to know ahead of time what you're going to write. It's great if you do have an idea, but just sitting yourself down and making sure, I don't know, commit for an hour, for example, every day, and you'll be amazed at the progress you make.
When we return, young adult author Ellie Delano will join us on the Sunbury Press Book Show.
Sunbury Press Books brings you the work of independent authors and serves readers, young and old alike. Speckled Egg Press is our juvenile nonfiction imprint. Check out the works from authors like Holly Garner, author of the Letters from Leo series, The Mouse with the Broken Tail by Dan Shutters, or The Adventures of Solomon Screech Owl, brought to us by Beth Lancione. Click on the Books tab at sunburypress.com and find authors and books you'll want to know.
We're back. Ellie Delano is the author of award-winning young adult and romance works. She discussed what brought her to Wakona.
Well, I try to take part in writer conferences anywhere I can find them. Even if they're writing outside my genre, there is something you can learn from every single author, and I have discovered that countlessly across the years. I'm not far away. I'm about 3 hours south. I'm near Amish country, kind of in that area. But this was a conference I hadn't attended before, and I really liked the slant of some of the workshops and lectures that are happening, so I decided to give it a whirl.
And that's the thing. It's like we have to go to the different events. We have to sort of branch out, and it's networking, but it's also that experience, and then you find new readers.
Exactly.
Well, describe your young adult fiction. I was taking a look at some of your titles here. Tell us about what you write in and how that's sort of spanned out over time.
Okay. Well, I actually started out in romance, and I have some of my titles here for today, too, under another pen name, and I've been doing that independently for about 12 years. And then I broke into young adult fiction in 2017, and that's traditional through Macmillan Publishing. And my first book was Traveler, which was a Keystone State Reading Association Book Award finalist that year. Mm-hmm. And it's about a young girl who steps through mirrors into alternate realities and alternate versions of herself. And the sequel to that was Dreamer, and that followed up in 2018. And then in 2021, I did Blue, which is a contemporary young adult, which is not my normal genre, but this book was eating my brain alive and wouldn't let go. So I wrote it out, and strangely enough, that's the one I've gotten the biggest accolades for. I normally write paranormal and fantasy all the time, but this was a departure for me. And
isn't it something like call young adult, new adult fiction, but there are times I just veer into other areas because an idea comes along, and I'm the kind of person that lets it cook for a while before I try to write anything because I don't really know what's happening here. And I guess the main fear for me is like I'm scared of repeating something that I've already done. So it's like I don't want to go over it again. So I want this thing to tell me what's different about you. How does it work for you? Does it cook for a while?
Usually, in the case of Blue, it was one of those things where I was, writing a completely different story, and that story ran in and waved its arms a few times, and I went, oh, okay, and I made a little notation, and that's what I do. I keep a Word document, just a running Word document of little bitty ideas that have hit me while I'm working a deadline on something else. And I kept going back to it and thinking, what am I going to do with this thing? Because it's not my, this isn't normal for me. And I pitched it to one of my editors, and she just basically said, wait a minute, you're a fantasy writer. And, this is a big five publisher. When they tell you you're a fantasy writer, you're a fantasy writer. So I kind of put it on a back burner, and then eventually I found an indie press who was willing to take it on, and it ended up being a very good thing.
Must have been just a bit shocking. But then again, from what I've read from other authors, it's like they'll always say things, or not always, but they'll often say things like, oh, my editor's on me to do bestseller part two, part three, part four. This is what's happened.
Business. If you write one sort of certain type of song, they want you to stay with that certain type of song, you know.
And they want the next record.
And
of
they
the
want
same
the
thing.
Next one that sounds a lot like that, so people know that's your artist because they all sound kind of similar. And it can be the same way in publishing, particularly in, you know, Big Five publishing. They have your like cliche sort of genres that they stick you in, and then deviation is kind of hard, especially when you're new. You know, I only had two books under my belt at that time. If I had 20, they might have been willing to say, okay, let's branch out a little. Let's try something new.
And I understand that from their standpoint as well. They have to move something. But at the same time, it's the thing is, these are things we write for us. These are things that we love. And I must ask now, was romance at the beginning of this, was that your primary influence? What were you reading that led you to think, I can write my own things?
Well, the funny thing was, I was writing romance, which is my true love, of course. And I'd been doing that at that time for, you know, 8 or 9 years. And I was trying to break into traditional publishing. And I was sitting at my day job with one of my coworkers, and I said, you know, don't know if I should try for romance or if I should try for something else.
Right.
And she said, well, if you're writing romance, that's what you should probably do. And I said, yeah, but, you know, I'm going on Twitter to manuscript wish list, and I'm looking through all these wish lists on people's websites, and everybody's looking for YA. You mm-hmm. know, this was right around the time of Twilight, you know,
yes.
Hunger Games, all the Maze Runner, all the big YA, you know, sort of franchises. And I said, everybody's looking for YA. And she said, well, what do you read? And I said, YA. I read a lot of YA, actually. You know, I read romance, but I read a lot of YA. So she said, go ahead and, you know, try, come up with an idea and go from there. So I actually had this is kind of a strange, freaky thing that happened to me. When I was 5 or 6, I was watching a television show, like an old rerun of Alice in Wonderland made by the BBC, like
right.
it was in black and white kind of thing. And I had watched the sequel, Alice Through the Looking Glass, that they did. And, you know, that's Alice stepping, she sees another world on the other side of the mirror, and it's just kind of a weird thing. And I was walking back to my bedroom after watching that, and the hallway was kind of dark, and there was a mirror on the wall in the hallway, and I kind of stopped in front of it and gave it a look and kind of stared at it a minute, like, wow, what if there really was a world on the other side? And I was staring really hard at myself in the mirror, and I swear to God, the other me blinked, and I did not. And
wow.
from that day on, it freaked me out. So as my coworker says, you should come up with a YA idea, I happened to glance over at my computer monitor, which had gone dark and into screensaver mode, and caught a glimpse of myself. And it's been a lifelong thing. When I catch a side glimpse of myself in a mirror, it's sort of dark in a mirror, I get an instant chill because I go back to that moment. And then the idea hit me, wait a minute.
There you
I can
are.
Take that and go with the world on the other side of the mirror and see where that goes. And that's how it came about. So
that's cool. And the thing, too, that people have asked me, because at my age, it's like I primarily write young adult / new adult. And that's just kind of where I've fallen into. And that was what came to me over the last several years. And I've had people ask me, is there something that connects you to it? And for me, it's going back to a part of my youth that I lost and I don't really have. It's not just about me. It's about the people that I remember, and it's also the people around me. Crafting of characters, crafting of, like, how do they come to you?
Oh, boy. Sometimes I, like, literally, I always cast my novel in my head.
Right.
And maybe that's a celebrity. Maybe that's the lady that was behind me in the grocery store griping at her kid. You know, maybe that's a combination of two people.
Yeah.
And I'm currently writing a novel. It's my one character is a combination of another character from someone else's book who's a real person, and Mr. Rogers. That's how I'm combining it. I want that wisdom. I want that sharp. I want that she catches everything, but I want kindness
right.
with that. So I sort of merge those two together. So it's just kind of a weird thing for me because my main character is almost always the last one that comes together for me in my mind.
Okay.
Like, I always have my supporting cast. I always have the love interest in mind. But the main character is kind of a thing for me. She sort of evolves as I'm going through, and that isn't always a clear image at the beginning, and that's something I struggle with as a writer.
I'm going through that right now. Mm-hmm. I have a character that I'm still trying to figure out who it is, and that is usually the main character is the quick one for me. It's like suddenly I know who I want, and then you have to spend time. Someone said this a long time. Actually, I know who it was Peter Garrett from Midnight Oil. I did an interview with him a long time ago, and he made an interesting comment about his songs. And he said, paraphrasing, these are songs that I want people to get close to and I hope become friends with and like, something like that. And that always stuck with me. And it's like, I necessarily them as they may be. And hopefully you make friends with them. Hopefully there's someone that you identify with a little bit. And that makes the story better. So I take my time with my characters. And I hope that I make them as good as I can.
Yeah, I always say, especially since I write a lot of paranormal and fantasy work. Someone asked me once, how do you write people on another planet or, at another time, things like that. And I said, you got to write who you know mm-hmm. in a fantastical place or a fantastical situation. And that's basically what fantasy writing or paranormal writing is. I'm still writing people I know.
Right.
I'm writing things that are universal to us all. We all fall in love. We all feel betrayed sometimes. We all feel terrified. We all overcome that terror to take on something bigger and feel triumphant when we do. So, these are the things you look for.
And the things that I point out, and some people have asked me about some of the things that go on in some of my writings, and I'm like, these are the things I experienced. These are the things my friends experienced. These are things we went through. We cannot all live idyllic, sweet little lives. I mean, hey, terrific if you did, but you have to have sort of the grit and the underlying things that occur, and it's not always easy. And because as I like to say, life can be this way. Mm-hmm. And I think it makes for better stories because they're more realistic. And you hope for that.
And you mentioned earlier about, you write about the way you wish your youth had been. And that's also a key thing when you're writing because, you're writing situations you know or that you've heard other people express their feelings about. But sometimes you want to write that situation as it should have been.
Yeah.
And, or as it could have been.
Yeah. And, of course, the could have and should have for me is just kind of like, well, if it didn't happen, my life might not have gone the way that it did. Or that situation might have been even worse than it was.
Exactly. Dodged a bullet, thank God.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the way I look at it now is just like, look, this is just the way my life went. And mm-hmm. The mistakes we make are, you hope, learning experiences. Mm-hmm. And, if you were hidden away or you were protected too much, you might have missed something. And so who knows how it's supposed to go out.
Exactly.
Let me ask you, though, what is next for you? You're talking about some new work.
Yes, I have a book coming out next month called In the Dark of a Dream, and it's about a young girl with night terrors.
Ooh.
Who recently experienced the death of her father. She was moved to an island where her mother lives that's okay. housed by it's a compound run by a very high-security biotech company mm-hmm. who does nanotechnology.
Right.
And her mother and father co-founded the company before they divorced, and she's been living with the dad all this time. So now she's with mom, who she's been estranged from, and since she's come to the island, her night terrors have gotten really horrible. And she's dreaming every night about battle scenarios, everything from laser beams to guns to swords and arrows and rocks and sticks. She's fighting all sorts of people with this same squad of soldiers in every scenario, and they feel terribly real.
Mm.
And what ends up happening is she finds out there's a group of soldiers stuck in a nanotechnology experiment somewhere on the island, and she is falling into it.
Wow.
So she is their only hope to get them out.
Wow. Interesting. Well, I am really glad I got to talk with you. And one thing I always ask, what's the best piece of advice you would give to an aspiring author or somebody who has an idea but doesn't really know how to proceed?
The same advice I give everybody. Just write the book. just write it. The difference between a published author and someone who just writes is they finished a book, and you're not going to get anywhere till you finish it. So avoid the temptation to write 17 half books, which was what I used to do. I mean, I had so many ideas, and then, you know, you get to the muddle in the middle and you sort of peter out and you pick up something else. Right. And you might go back and write on that a little, but what you end up with is what I call irons in the fire syndrome. You have 20 half books sitting around you and nothing to show for it. So pick one, put everything you've got into it, and finish the thing.
Coming up, Stephen Sherrill discusses Minotaurs, Motorcycles, and Despondent Man when the Sunbury Press Book Show returns.
Sunbury Press Books is the home of independent and diverse authors. Check out the Agency Books imprint for detective stories, tales of law enforcement, espionage, terrorism, spy thrillers, and more. Among the works available, KGB Banker by William Burton McCormick, The Apologist, a Luke Lundy novel by A.A. Weiss, and Douglas Brody's Sand or Once Upon a Time in the Jazz Age. Find these and other fascinating books at sunburypress.com.
Welcome back. We conclude this program with Stephen Sherrill, author of Motorcycles, Minotaurs, and Banjos, A Midwest Odyssey. A professor of creative writing at Penn State Altoona, Sherrill tells how he came to Wakona and leads us through his life, experiences, and gives us yet another side of Northern Appalachia.
I was invited. I gave a workshop at, I can't remember, the Altoona Regional Writers Group event. I gave a lecture there, and then I was at another book festival here in Ebensburg, and Kimberly and Jen Diamond invited me to this place. And I'm a relative native, so I know the area.
Okay. Tell us about where you're from in this region.
By native, I mean I've been here for 25 years. I grew up in North Carolina, but I've been in Pittsburgh at Penn State Altoona for 23, almost 24 years.
Okay.
Teaching English.
Okay. And yes, being from Vermont and being here for about 20-some-odd years, it's kind of like we're still newcomers, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Although I feel very much a Pennsylvanian now. My youngest daughter was born here. You know, of late, I like the politics of the place where I live in the state.
Okay.
So it's it feels like home. It's got this almost Midwestern welcoming feel to it.
Yes, and to parts of Pennsylvania too, northern New England, where I'm from, it kind of reminds me a little bit of it. Of course, Vermont had more mountains, but
yeah,
it was all good.
Yeah.
I have to say this. When I walked by your table, I was immediately taken by this lovely cover with the title Motorcycles, Minotaurs, and Banjos.
Yes.
Tell us about this, because there's that, and there's another story about Minotaurs. Tell me about where this comes from.
So Motorcycles, Minotaurs, and Banjos is my most recent book, published book, and it is, after much reluctance, legitimately a memoir. I resisted that term for a long time, but once my wife read and said, you need more of yourself in, I embraced it. The structure of the book is bookended or controlled by a 21-day motorcycle trip that I took 2 years ago. I left my house on my 60th birthday with a little banjo and a little motorcycle and a bunch of recording equipment, and I went south with no determined end time because I was on sabbatical. It took me 21 days, 2,500 miles, and I visited the graves of six of my banjo heroes and one murder victim, and I played and sang for them. And
wow.
It started out, I thought it was going to be a YouTube kind of project and videos and stuff. In the end, it very much became a writing project. So every day in the saddle, in the helmet, was thinking time. And every night I wouldn't go to sleep until I'd written up everything I'd thought about that day.
Wow.
So I have footage of all the stuff I did at the graves, but I never watched it.
Okay. I must ask, what motorcycle do you have?
A Royal Enfield. This one is a Royal Enfield Interceptor 650. And I don't know what your past with motorcycles is, but I've loved bikes my whole life. I've owned many. I chose this one really carefully because the Royal Enfield is one of, if not the longest in production bikes ever. Started in the UK, went to India. This particular model I'll step back and say that I despise doing mechanical work. I'm capable, but I don't like it. So the earlier Royal Enfields, the Bullets, they were very sexy, but I just wasn't interested in mechanics. This new machine, first released in 2020, is just mechanically tight and solid and gorgeous. And I saw it in a magazine, and I thought, I want that. And that kind of trigger is how the book developed. I want this bike. I want this trip. And then it became about the Minotaur, which traces back to, you know, my first book, which made the rest of my life possible. There's also my painting on the cover.
That is cool. And yes, tell us about the Minotaur.
So 30 years ago at this point. Well, I'm not a scholar. I don't like fantasy work at all. Never really read it. I was in graduate school in Iowa City. I was coming across the river on a bridge after having modeled for 2 hours for an art course, which was boring and painful. And the phrase, the Minotaur takes a cigarette break, fell into my head like that. I mean, as a creative person, that stuff happens all the time. Most of it is nonsense.
Right.
But I recognized the power of that title and had, by the end of that day, had written a poem that indirectly got me my first wife. That wife and I had a child. We were flying to Philadelphia Mother's Day, and I thought I could turn that into a novel. So my first novel had the same title and the same basic premise. It is the literal Minotaur with horns and a big snout and an inability to speak, but he is living in North Carolina circa 1990, cooking in a steakhouse and trying to find a girlfriend. And it's just 2 weeks of his life. And that book has been in print for 20-some years. It's in 7 or 8 languages. Neil Gaiman did it for his Audible launch thing. So that book made the whole rest of my life possible.
That's amazing.
Got me a job.
Yeah. That really is amazing. And I have to ask also about you played and sang for these folks, so you have a background in music. Tell me about that.
That was part of the struggle of the book. I have a lifelong desire to make music, but a deep, deep insecurity about doing it in front of anybody, right?
Same here.
Like, I would cripple myself with tab and couldn't read. If I knew a song and look at the tab, I could play it. As soon as I turned from tab, couldn't do it. Once I dropped all of that nonsense and thought, I'm just going to make noise for myself, it became a lot of fun. And I do some things in public that approximate music, but there's no vulnerability there. Like, I front a sea shanty choir sometimes, which is just stomping and screaming, right? So I can do that in public, but I could not get up and sing a pretty song by myself.
Hmm.
And so I went in part to discover music, right, and to grapple with music. And part of this Minotaur character that I created is about insecurity and identity and outsiderness. So grappling with all of that stuff became what that memoir was about.
Wow. And is that a theme throughout your writing, or is it just one of them?
No, I would say otherness and outsiderness is core to – and the factors that make one feel that way.
Right.
Is core to almost everything I've written novel-wise.
Mm-hmm. And – is there a way to describe your style? You must have a unique style by this point.
That's a terrible question. It's not a terrible question. It's a hard question. It didn't mean terrible. It approximates the fabulous, the magic realist. It really is the literal Minotaur, but I refuse to acknowledge that element. Like, you know, he bumps his horns into things, and it's just like, okay, he did this. It's
right.
Not like so I would say that aspect exists. And even in the books, those of my novels that don't have mythological characters at the core, the voice tends toward the magical and the strange and the gothic and incredibly dark.
And that is sometimes the thing that needs to come out of us. I mean, it's I don't know if it's an underlying theme of my own writing, but it may well be. There's the dark places that are – you poke them and you're not sure of what's going to come out of it, but sometimes you just have to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's necessary. I think it's necessary to poke those dark places, get that stuff out, because part of otherness is being made to feel other, where, you know, if I talk about this to my writing students in this context. Like, if you have a bad guy, if you have a villain, and he's purely evil, well, okay, there's not much to that. It's very shallow. If you humanize the bad guys and put a little monstrosity in the good guys, it makes them really human.
And it gives another look at the sides of them. It's funny because I was just in Ohio at an event, and one of the panels we had was about writing the perfect bad guy. And I wasn't there for it, but the general feeling I got out of it was that if you have a bad guy who's all bad and there's no redeeming characteristic, but there's the other part of – and I have few villains in my writing, but I have one really bad character.
Yeah.
But as I developed him over the years, there was a reason why he acted the way he did.
Yeah.
There was a reason why he became the person he did, and it's not to excuse what he has done, but at the same time, he can look back and hold on to something that it's almost like it's the one thing he's got left to keep from losing his grip.
Yeah, and it just makes him relatable and human.
You know,
unless you're talking about pure entertainment genre stuff, then you can have straight up bad guys, but I'm after something different. Sounds like you are too.
Yeah, and I must ask now about Despondent Man. This is an interesting one.
Despondent Man is also a relatively new project. It is also an idea that, like The Minotaur Takes a Cigarette Break as a title, just fell into my head. I've been watching the nonsense in my head for so long now that I don't really know or question where things come from. So Despondent Man is a figure. Despondent Man is a shabbily dressed, kneeling or slumped over human. And Despondent Man has a P.O. box, and Despondent Man has a valise. And anything that comes to that P.O. box, wishes or lies or dreams or anything, goes unlooked at, even by me. I don't actually talk about it. If something were to come to the mailbox,
right,
I would slip my hand in and not look and slip it into the valise. That's all I'll ever say. I'll never acknowledge what's there because I don't actually know. I'll never acknowledge receiving something from anyone. So it's a little bit about having faith in my part of the project and whatever the sender's desires might be.
Mm-hmm.
So I take this guy around. He's been to Rochester. He's been to Bristol, Tennessee. He's brand new, so he's still kind of expanding. And I post pictures. He's got an Instagram page. He's got a website. And I only post latitude, longitude, time, and date.
Wow.
And people resonate with this guy. Like, I've been pleasantly surprised with the humans that I interact with who see him in wherever he is,
mm-hmm.
and the response is fun. It's fun, then it goes beyond fun.
It's that thing. It's that character that people maybe recognize in themselves.
Yep.
And that's what I try to look for with characters is give people something that maybe they look at that person and say, hey, I know them.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, wow, that could be me, that kind of thing. I have to ask about teaching English and teaching at your level. What is it like to have these new generations of students and potential writers, potential poets? What are you seeing from them?
Well, I will have to preface my answer by saying that I am phasing retirement and I'm sort of done. Like I've been teaching in some context for almost 30 years, and it's really time for me to, you know, give that energy to younger people. The way that I have developed my teaching, my pedagogy has been consistently kind of growing and developing. I can get the same kinds of things deeper and deeper because I'm getting more skilled at it, but the kids don't really change. The surroundings change, COVID changes, technology changes, but the humans in the seats are still the humans in the seats. And I only teach creative writing at this point. Beginning is my favorite because I can snag, you know, little freshmen and carry them for 4 years. And they do. They follow me for, you know, as long as they can. And then upper level and beginning fiction. So I have a very limited range of what I'm willing to do, and I've been allowed to make that claim. I don't see a difference in the humans in the seats. The other stuff is different, and I have no interest at all in navigating Chat GPT and AI. It's not going to go away. We'll find some way to use it.
Right.
I'm just not interested in doing that. So that's coming. My wife is also a teacher, and she's absolutely having to engage it.
So, do you think that this new technology is it going to change the creativity? Because I still think, in my own view, that we're still going to create. Humans are still going to make stuff.
No, I think for, you know, eras past, eons past, the majority of people aren't so interested in making and, you know, are interested and willing to just take entertainment that comes their way or whatever. So I think there's going to be a whole medium tier of AI-generated genre stuff that'll satisfy a whole bunch of readers.
Right.
But as you say, people who are driven to make are going to keep making, and those people tend to be people who also want to consume stuff made by real humans. So we're not going to go away.
Right.
You know?
Well, where can people find your work?
My website. I mean, I'm all over Amazon. I'm all over you. If you just type my name in.
All right.
Good. I mean, I think there's a convict in Tennessee with my name, and I think there's a preacher down south with my name. So put in Despondent Man, you'll get to me.
All right. Last question. What is the one piece of advice you give someone who wants to create, wants to write, has an idea, but maybe doesn't quite know how to proceed just yet?
Drive ahead with, like, this is what my hands-on workshop was about this morning. Like, that stage of indecision can cripple, and that stage of indecision can start with a blank page, the second sentence, the middle paragraphs, or the end. Like, it's that willingness to sort of drive fearlessly ahead without concern at the formative stages, without concern for final product. Like, people get completely consumed by this notion of what if it's not good or whatever,
right?
So much so that they don't have a final draft or a first draft to work with. Well, if you can drive through that first draft, that's it. It's like perseverance and just charge fearlessly ahead. Like, what's the worst that's going to happen? The writing will be bad for a minute. Who cares?
My thanks to Hillary, L.E., and Stephen for their time. Since 2019, Wakona has continued to grow, and as you have heard, the voices of this region are many, diverse, and creative. We hope to bring more of these voices and those of the past to you through the BookSpeak Network, Sunbury Press, and our imprint Catamount Press. Find out more about the Writers' Conference of Northern Appalachia at WCONA.com. Thank you for listening to the Sunbury Press Book Show on the BookSpeak Network. Check out our website at www.sunburypress.com for our latest releases. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter to receive special offers and discounts.